Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
I'm Lise Doucette from the Global Story Podcast. We're looking at how gang violence has pushed Haiti to the brink of anarchy. The authorities have lost control. The Prime Minister has been forced to resign. Can a new leadership restore peace to Haiti? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 14th of March, these are our main stories. China has described a potential US ban on TikTok as an act of bullying. Israel says it's investigating a strike on a UN food distribution centre in Gaza. The Dutch populist leader Geert Wilders has abandoned his bid to become prime minister, despite his party's dramatic victory in last year's election. Also in this podcast...
That's the way I breathe. The only person in the world that knows how to do it.
Tenacious and brave for seven decades. One man's life well lived in an iron lung. The US House of Representatives has passed a bill that could force the Chinese owners of TikTok, the social media platform, to either sell the app or be banned in the US. The measure received widespread bipartisan backing. It now goes to the Senate, where some lawmakers say they will oppose it. The vote increases tensions between Beijing and Washington over who controls technology that could affect national security and free speech. The leading House Democrat, Hakeem Jeffries, said if the measure is approved by the Senate, US consumers will be more protected.
I don't support a ban on TikTok. The legislation did not ban TikTok. It's simply a divestiture of TikTok, so that this social media platform can be owned by an American company that would protect the data and the privacy of the American consumer from malignant foreign interests like the Chinese Communist Party.
Among those who voted against the bill was the Republican congresswoman from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who sits on the far right of her party.
When the government moves into forcing the sale of TikTok, who is going to buy it? Who will be the next to control the data of over 170 million Americans? Are we going to trust Mark Zuckerberg to control their data? I certainly don't. By the way, most of the time, my posts on Facebook are shadow banned, and I certainly don't have the reach on that social media account.
I spoke to our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal. So, in general, can we say a rare example of bipartisanship in Congress?
It's interesting because it was a large majority in the House, 352 to 65. I think for the Republicans, and this was a Republican-led bill, Donald Trump was the person who spearheaded this in the first place, certainly when he was in office, saying that TikTok was a threat to national security. That's the claim that he made. And then President Biden picked it up when he was in office as well, agreeing with it. And so I think And in a sense, because both of them have backed it, you've got this bipartisan agreement on it. Having said that, it's not been received very well by those who use it. I was just outside the White House where there's a protest going on, and lots of young people who use it were saying, "Look, this isn't just some app where we go on to look at funny videos and dancing videos and what have you. I've got my business on there, I've got my livelihood on there, and if it goes, then that goes." And for them, they said to me that this was an issue for them when it comes to voting in the election.
So they don't seem to, or some people at least, don't seem to accept what the leading House Democrat, Mr. Jeffries, was saying, that it's to protect US consensus and consumers against malignant foreign interests like the Chinese Communist Party. So what happens next?
Well, I think the problem is that they've never actually proven any actual evidence that it is a threat in that respect. And this is what TikTok's argument is. They say, look, if you're concerned that American users' data is being sent to China, well, we have this massive firewall which walls off any information going to China. It's kept within servers in the US, although there's been various investigations that suggest that firewall's actually porous and information has got to China. I just want to quote one woman I spoke to outside the White House named Lindsay. She said to me, look, if my information is being used in another country, fine, I don't care. That's my right. My information in for apps used in America is being used here. So she said that she wasn't too concerned about that. In terms of what happens next, well, it does go to the Senate, but I think it faces an uncertain future because senators are pretty divided about the legislation. Also, I want to add that President Biden has started a TikTok account for his election campaign, and Donald Trump has flip-flopped, saying that he doesn't want a ban. I think we can put that down to the fact that they are worried they might miss out on millions and millions of young voters.
Nomi Iqbal in Washington. Well, China described the potential ban of TikTok in the US as an act of bullying. TikTok's Beijing-based owners, ByteDance, say they've gone to great lengths to protect the data of its 170 million US users. US lawmakers say ByteDance has links with the Chinese Communist Party, something denied by the company and TikTok. So what's been the reaction in China to the potential ban? Here's our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
I've been reading lots of really strong lines in Chinese media this week ahead of the House vote on TikTok. For example, the National Global Times newspaper was criticising that the vote was even taking place. It said that scrutiny of the platform demonstrated the US's ugly behaviour, and it saw the vote as a way of the US seizing TikTok and taking it by force from China. Now that the bill has been passed in the US House of Representatives, meaning that ByteDance has to sell its stake in the app in the next 6 months, it's clear that Chinese social media users are not happy at all. Many have been watching the US House vote in real time, despite most foreign media being blocked in mainland China. And I'm seeing lots of comments from angry Chinese users at the suggestion that TikTok will either have to divest control, sell its US operations, or face a ban in the US. One Weibo user says that the vote has left them speechless, and another says that if the US does take ownership of TikTok, that will be blatant robbery of the platform. I think it's worth mentioning that we have been here before. Back in 2020, former President Donald Trump signed a presidential order directing ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, to sell off the social media platform within 90 days or face a ban. And at that time, TikTok's founder, Jiang Yiming, was heavily criticised in China for suggesting that he might divest TikTok's US operations. He did eventually step down as chief executive of the firm. And there are people who think that that was because he had shown weakness and not had the courage to stand up to the US. They felt that he had never recovered from Chinese backlash to this suggestion. Now, what I'm seeing today is many Chinese social media users expressing confidence that China will not sell off its US TikTok operations. But what they do think is that now it's only a matter of time before TikTok leaves the US. And they are conscious that this could have a snowball effect, with other countries, particularly those in the West, looking to ban TikTok as well, if the US does so.
Kerry Allen. Next to Strasbourg in France, where the European Parliament has approved what it calls a trailblazing law on the use of artificial intelligence, or AI. The technology allows computers to learn and solve problems almost like human beings. Well, the President of the Parliament, Roberta Metsola, said the new AI rules balance tech innovation with respect for people's fundamental rights.
The European Parliament voted on the world's most advanced artificial intelligence legislation. Our groundbreaking AI law will allow us to be world leaders in digital and tech innovation based on EU democratic values, because Europe has the ability to set the tone worldwide and lead responsibly.
The legislation comes in the wake of the extraordinary speed at which artificial intelligence is developing, particularly in the field of chatbots like ChatGPT. Our technology reporter Chris Vallance told us about the key elements of this new legislation.
I mean, the law takes a risk-based approach, so it depends on how risky things are, essentially in terms of their risk to society, the risk to individuals, in terms of how they're regulated. Some unacceptable risks are flat out banned. So, for example, things like emotion recognition in the workplace and schools, you know, for example, AI tech that might monitor attention also certain kinds of sort of biometric systems. One that got a lot of attention, a lot of debate, was the issue of live facial recognition and its use. And the compromise that was reached in the end was that law enforcement could use live facial recognition cameras and that sort of thing, but only in the case of the most serious crimes. Then you go to the next tier of risk, which is high risk things. And there it depends on use. Now, AI is used in lots of different fields, all of which can have a big impact on people's lives. So, for example, medical uses, uses in employment, uses in critical infrastructure. And there are sort of rules that mandate things like transparency and human oversight. And then you get into other areas of AI, and you know, it's a long list. So I don't know how much tape you have, but essentially you then get things like generative AI. These are the chatbots, for example, in terms of the production of images and the production of text, which we've all become fascinated by. You know, they'll have to do things like, say, which kind of copyrighted materials they use to train those AIs. I mean, a lot of artists and a lot of writers are upset about that. So that's a very broad brush picture.
Chris, these are rules that will have to be followed by European Union countries. It's fine, for example, if you say to a police force in a democracy, you cannot use this particular facial recognition software. However, what about globally? There are all sorts of actors and all sorts of states who will not respect this.
Well, yeah, you know, the jurisdiction of this is interesting. When you talk to lawyers, I was talking to one lawyer who said a lot of companies might choose to comply with it, even if they don't have a particularly big footprint in the EU, because there's a chance their tech could be used by, say, another company in the EU, and then it might become subject to the Act. And we did get one statement from a vice president at IBM who said, I commend the EU for its leadership in passing comprehensive smart legislation, so broadly positive from them.
So when it comes to countries, I suppose China comes to mind, using AI, using facial recognition technology quite extensively. What plans do they have to regulate AI?
There are a number of announcements and sort of regulations that have been made by the various Chinese bodies involved in regulating tech. So they've made announcements. There also, of course, there were moves at the G7 meeting where cooperation on AI regulation was raised, and there were sort of broad agreements and sort of, you know, positive noises made about that. And again, at the summit in the UK, organised by the UK government, various countries sort of committed to broad statements about the risks posed by AI and the need for regulation. So countries around the world are taking steps to regulate AI. But, you know, the EU, as far as it's concerned, has taken the lead.
Chris Vallance. Israel says it's looking into an attack on a United Nations food distribution centre in Rafah City. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says one of its staff was killed in an apparent Israeli airstrike on the centre. Four others died and more than 20 were injured in the incident. Well, the head of the UN agency, Philippe Lazzarini, said the strike was carried out despite the location of the centre being given to Israeli forces on Monday. At a US State Department media briefing in Washington, the American Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, called on Israel to ensure aid workers were protected.
The Israeli military, the Israeli government have a responsibility and an obligation to do everything possible to ensure that the humanitarians can do their jobs. And among other things, that means making sure that if there's a humanitarian facility that's clearly identified, it's not struck.
More than 160 staff from UNRWA have been killed in Gaza since the war began. An Israeli hostage who was kidnapped by Hamas gunmen during last year's 7th of October attacks has told the BBC News that the world has forgotten about those held captive. Hamas is regarded as a terrorist group by many Western governments. Itai Regev was taken hostage with his sister and his friend from a music festival. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
Itai Regev is free, but all he thinks about are the hostages he left behind. The teenager was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival with his sister Maya and his friend Omer. Itai says they were taken to a house in Gaza with a shaft, then through a tunnel and to a hospital, as he and his sister had both been shot in the leg. Itai's words are translated by an actor.
They threatened me with my life. They are going to kill me. They are going to behead me. I still had a bullet in my leg. They put the forceps into my leg. They pulled out the bullet without anaesthetic. They told me to keep quiet, because if I won't keep quiet, they'll kill me. I came to terms with the fact that I wasn't going to live. I see my sister Maya, injured and crying. Maya also said her goodbyes and told me, if I come out of this alive, to tell our parents that she loves them.
Isai says they didn't know each day if they would be killed by their captors or hit by a missile. Sometimes there was no water and they suffered greatly from hunger. He was freed after 54 days, a few days after Maya. Omer and around 130 others are still being held. The negotiations to release the remaining hostages have stalled. Hamas is demanding a permanent ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli troops. Itai says the Israeli government must do all it can to bring the hostages home.
Lucy Manning. Russia says it's going to deploy troops and strike systems near its border with Finland. It comes after both Finland and Sweden joined NATO, more than doubling the length of the alliance's border with Russia. In a wide-ranging interview with state-controlled Russian television ahead of this weekend's election, President Putin singled out neighbouring Finland. He said the decision to join the Western Defence Alliance was, in his opinion, clearly against Helsinki's own interest. Alice Adley reports.
The sight of 90,000 troops from 32 countries taking part in NATO's biggest exercise for decades in Norwegian waters recently may have concentrated Vladimir Putin's mind when giving his interview. For the Russian public, he's always framed his full-scale invasion of Ukraine as a defensive military operation against an expanding NATO. This act has made Nordic and Baltic countries nervous of the same thing happening to them and has led directly to the accession of first Finland and most recently historically neutral Sweden to the alliance. President Putin singled out Finland, which joined the alliance last year.
We generally had ideal relations with Finland, simply ideal. We didn't have a single claim against each other, especially territorial ones, not to mention in other areas. We didn't have troops there either. We removed all the troops from the Russian-Finnish border. Why do they do this? Based on purely political considerations, in my opinion. They really wanted to be members of a Western club under some kind of umbrella. Why they needed this, I frankly don't understand.
The NATO alliance regularly holds drills, and membership of what Mr. Putin calls the Western club ensures an attack on a member state means allies will come to its aid. The message from NATO in running its exercise Operation Steadfast Defender in the Nordic region is clear. It's prepared to defend itself against an increasingly aggressive Russia. Moscow has recently switched its economy to war mode, and the fear is, if it makes gains in Ukraine, it may turn its attention to the increasingly strategically important mineral-rich Arctic region.
Alice Adley. The far-right Dutch politician Geert Wilders has failed in his bid to become prime minister, even though his party emerged as the biggest in last November's elections. From The Hague, here's Anna Holligan.
He may have convinced a considerable portion of the Dutch electorate, but Geert Wilders failed to reassure the other party leaders that he was a suitable person to lead the country. Despite promises to put some of his most controversial and unconstitutional policies regarding Islam on ice, Mr. Wilders has accepted if he wants a right-wing government, he'll have to sacrifice his own political ambitions to lead it.
Anna Holligan. A man from the United States who survived polio and became known as the man in the iron lung has died at the age of 78. Paul Alexander, who was from the state of Texas, contracted the virus in 1952 and was left paralysed from the neck down. It's thought he was one of the last people in the world to be using an iron lung. That's a metal cylinder that encased his body and used air pressure to help him breathe. Ellie Price has been looking back at his life.
Paul Alexander spent more than 70 years enclosed in a pressurised metal cylinder with just his head and neck sticking out. Last year, he entered the Guinness World Records as the longest ever iron lung patient. But that wasn't his most impressive accolade. After catching polio when he was six, he was paralysed and unable to breathe on his own. Placed in an iron lung, he was not expected to survive long. But after several years, Paul Alexander taught himself to gulp down air into his throat and mastered what he called frog breathing. It meant, eventually, he could spend short periods away from his iron lung, as he explained in his own words in this documentary a few years ago.
That's the way I breathe, gulping in air. The only person in the world that knows how to do it.
He would go on to earn a law degree, practice law for several decades, as well as publish a memoir. His brother Philip said he was an inspiration.
I've seen him go through a lot of struggles over the years. And, you know, he had a caregiver living with him for a good while. But, I mean, after that, she lived down the street. He lived in his own house. Since then, he's had his own apartment. I admire him a lot for that.
A polio vaccine was developed in the 1950s, all but eradicating the disease in the Western world shortly after. Advances in medicine made iron lungs obsolete a decade later, replaced by other forms of ventilators. But Paul Alexander kept living in the cylinder he called his old iron horse because, he said, he was used to it.
Ellie Price. Still to come.
It is plausible that in humans, the same selective pressures meant that menopause evolved in order to produce helpful grandmothers.
What whales can teach humans about the reason for the menopause?
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
I'm Lise Doucette from the Global Story podcast. We're looking at how gang violence has pushed Haiti to the brink of anarchy. The authorities have lost control. The Prime Minister has been forced to resign. Can a new leadership restore peace to Haiti? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Next to the crisis in Haiti, political instability and violence in the country continues to dominate the lives of the people. Despite efforts by regional leaders, including the United States, to find a solution to the crisis, it is clear that armed gangs are largely in control of the country. They have successfully forced the resignation of the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, who they accuse of corruption and trying to cling on to power despite his mandate expiring. Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, a former policeman, is the most high profile of the gang leaders, but others are challenging him for dominance. How are the gangs being financed then? Romain Lecour of the Geneva-based NGO Global Initiative is an expert on violence and organised crime.
Because they control, let's say, 80 to 85% of the country's capital, but also specific and strategic routes, they have been able to extract resources and funding through, first and foremost, extortion. So you have checkpoints operating, especially different parts of the capital. The capital was and is still absolutely sealed by criminal checkpoints. So if you're into logistics business, for example, and you run the truck company just has to pay the gangs to operate. It's the same in the port. You cannot get anything in and out the terminal without paying Barbecue's group. So they have been able just to transform their access to assault rifles, for example, and war weapons, mainly and largely from the United States. This firepower has allowed them to better control their territory, but also to expand into new activities like kidnappings, for example. Kidnappings is a huge part of their funding. In some weeks of 2023, people were reporting from 500 to 1,000 kidnappings in 1 week. And to pay the ransom, people in Haiti sell everything they have, start asking for money around their friends, families. You have people in the diaspora sending money. And let's say if you do 10,000 kidnappings per year, and if you're charging just like $5,000 or $10,000 per kidnapping, this is a huge amount of money. And kidnappings have become a kind of industry.
Romain Lecour from the Global Initiative Organization in Geneva. Biden versus Trump. It is the coming contest, as both candidates have now reached the magic number of delegates to become their party's nominee to run for US president. It is the first rematch since Adlai Stevenson versus Dwight Eisenhower in 1956. Things can still derail Biden or Trump making it through to November, but we can work on the assumption that the voters know the choice they have to make. Many, of course, have made up their minds. Many have not, particularly perhaps those Republicans of anti-Trump inclination. The BBC's North America editor, Sarah Smith, has been meeting voters in Wisconsin.
Breaking overnight, it is official. President Biden and Donald Trump set for a 2024 rematch.
It's a rerun of the 2020 election that is set to be one of the longest presidential election campaigns in modern American history.
The stage is officially set. Trump versus Biden. As the president heads to battleground Wisconsin today.
Here in Wisconsin, politics already dominates the radio talk shows.
Here on the Dan O'Donnell Show, it's classical conservatism and contemporary style. We are partisans for truth here.
WISN listeners get a daily blast of non-stop, high-energy, right-wing rhetoric from this radio host who is very clear about who he wants to see in the White House.
Trump is the sun, and everything else in the political solar system revolves around him in some way.
You think he can win the presidential election?
Oh, absolutely.
Despite
absolutely.
All the voters who say they'll never vote for him.
Yes, despite all of that, I mean, I honestly believe that Trump is the prohibitive favorite right now. All of the swing state polls show him up. In 2020, Trump didn't lead in a single swing state poll, not one. He's now leading in all of them.
One campaign group is spending $50 million to try to reverse Donald Trump's momentum. Called Republican Voters Against Trump, they've made a series of video testimonials from people who have voted for him in the past, explaining why they can't support him this year.
My name is Chuck. I live in Atlanta, Georgia.
My name is Brock Cordero. I'm from Dartmouth, Massachusetts.
And I did vote for Trump. Wasn't the best decision I think I've ever made. In fact, I think it's one of my poorest decisions I've ever made.
My name is Cynthia. I am from Pennsylvania. I am a former Trump supporter and voter. I will no longer be voting for President Trump.
We can survive 4 years of Biden. I don't know if we can survive 4 years of Trump. There is no
About 30% of Republican primary voters did not support Donald Trump. Now, many of them will vote for him in November because he's the Republican candidate. The question, though, is how many will refuse to. In the pretty little Wisconsin town of Waukesha, I met James Wigderson, a lifelong Republican who says he cannot vote for his party's candidate this year.
Why not? Because the man is a menace. He is a threat to the constitutional order. I will probably vote for Joe Biden, actually.
Really? You'll vote for a Democrat?
Yeah, it'll be really difficult. I'm not a fan of Joe Biden, and we can debate policies, and we can debate whether or not Joe Biden is a jerk or whether or not he's old. But in the end, what is the most important thing that we have to worry about in this country, and that's defending our Constitution? It's going to be hard, but it's necessary.
Are there enough Republicans like you who will vote against Donald Trump to stop him getting back into the White House?
I hope that there's enough Republicans in this state that have had enough. They have said that they're not going to support Donald Trump in his efforts to just win the election just so he can have his Donald Trump to the revenge tour. That's not something that they want to have happen.
Wisconsin will be one of the few states that determines the election outcome this year. Voters here backed Donald Trump in 2016 and Joe Biden in 2020. Each time it was only around 20,000 votes that made the difference. If Joe Biden can keep hold of enough unhappy Republicans here, he may be able to keep hold of the White House.
Sarah Smith. In March 2011, an earthquake triggered a tsunami in Japan that flooded the Fukushima nuclear power plant. 150,000 people were forced to flee the radiation leak that followed. The cleanup will take decades, but on Wednesday, one part of that process got the seal of approval from the International Atomic Energy Agency. The IAEA said the treated radioactive wastewater from the plant that's currently being released into the ocean is safe. Rafael Grossi, the agency's chief, posted a video on X, complete with safety hard hat and the sound of flowing water behind him.
We are making sure, as we said from the very beginning, that the IAEA would be present before, during and after this very important operation and until the last drop of water is safely dispersed into the ocean. Nuclear safety comes first. The IAEA is here. We will continue permanently following this important operation.
For more, I spoke to our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow.
Well, this trip was mainly about trying to assess whether or not this process of releasing water, which began 6 months ago, is actually going according to plan. Before Japan started releasing the water, it did get the approval of the International Atomic Energy Agency. They said that they were going to be there throughout the process to check independently it was all going according to plan. And that's what Rafael Grossi is doing in Japan, in Fukushima at the moment. And he said exactly that. It's safe. It's going well. He was there essentially to reassure Japanese people and the rest of the world that nothing was going wrong with this process.
Mickey, how do they know it's going safely and what tests are being made in the waters to make sure it is safe?
Well, exactly that. They're doing tests, not just of the water, but of the seabed, of the fish. They're periodically carrying out their own tests. They're not just relying on TEPCO, which is the owner of this stricken nuclear power plant. They're doing their own tests. So the IAEA is an independent organisation. It has scientists and analysts from across the world as its scientific advisors. So essentially what Rafael Grossi is trying to make the world sees that it's an independent organisation carrying out its own independent tests in Fukushima, so you can rely on what it has to say.
And yet there are still concerns locally and internationally, aren't there?
There are still concerns locally. There was a protest a little while ago in Japan against this. But interestingly, seafood sales haven't been affected in Japan. So that just really tells you what majority of people must feel, that the seafood from around Japan, from around this area, is safe. The people who don't really believe what Rafael Grossi is saying, what the Japanese are saying, are the Chinese. When they started discharging water last August, China introduced a ban on all seafood imports from Japan. That's still in place. China doesn't look as though it's going to change that. It wants Japan to just stop discharging water into the sea. So at the moment, that market has been affected. But China really is an outlier now. Other countries are coming to see, and even Japanese people, that this perhaps, probably is a safe procedure.
Mickey Bristow. The eldest son of France's former president, General Charles de Gaulle, has died aged 102. The last surviving child of the wartime leader, Philippe de Gaulle, became a significant figure in his own right. Warren Bull reports.
Philippe de Gaulle was a student at the time of the German Nazi invasion of France in 1940. He escaped to Britain and joined the Free French Naval Forces. He fought in several significant Second World War battles, including the liberation of Paris. Despite that, his father never awarded him the Liberation Medal given to heroes of the resistance, most likely over concerns about nepotism. Philippe de Gaulle saw active service in post-war conflicts in Indochina and North Africa. He wrote an acclaimed book about his father and served as a right-wing senator. In a statement, President Emmanuel Macron said Philippe de Gaulle had represented a century of French bravery.
Warren Bull. It is a mystery that's baffled scientists for decades. Why is it that only humans and some species of marine mammals go through the menopause? Well, most species continue to reproduce until the end of their lives, but researchers at the University of Exeter in England now believe that a study of killer whales may have provided the answer as to why a small number do not. More from our science correspondent, Helen Briggs.
Killer whales are among the handful of species known to go through the menopause. By studying them, scientists hope to solve a biological puzzle. In evolutionary terms, stopping reproducing partway through your life doesn't make a great deal of sense, given the drive to pass on your genes. But researchers at the University of Exeter have discovered the five whale species that go through menopause have a longer lifespan. This suggests the menopause evolved to allow grandmother whales to help younger generations survive without producing more mouths to feed. Professor Rebecca Sear, an anthropologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who's not connected with the research, says the same might be true in humans.
It is plausible that in humans too, the same selective pressures meant that menopause evolved in order to produce helpful grandmothers and to reduce reproductive competition between generations.
The jury is still out on the evolution of human menopause, with some suggesting it's simply a consequence of living for a long time.
Helen Briggs. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
I'm Lise Doucette from the Global Story podcast. We're looking at how gang violence has pushed Haiti to the brink of anarchy. The authorities have lost control. The Prime Minister has been forced to resign. Can a new leadership restore peace to Haiti? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.